welcome to Endnotes. My name is Sheila Broderick. In this programme, we invite people to share their funeral playlist and their thoughts about death, dying, ritual, the afterlife, if they believe in one. Today, my guest is John Keating. John was born in 1962 to Anne, a loving mother who is still alive and well, and his father Pierce, who died in 2011. As a child, he never called his father Father or Dad or Pierce, but always Perry. He recognised in his father someone who was an imp, a rogue, a friend, and a caring, loving man. John grew up in Ballintemple, as was then a small village, with Blackrock a small fishing village. No Mahon, no Jack Lynch tunnel, just fields. It was a very happy childhood. John found great joy in rowing, joining Lee Rowing Club at the age of 12, and rowed until the age of 18. The sport instilled a great sense of discipline and how important the concept of working together was. On finishing his Leaving Cert, college was not calling him. Travel took its place, and in his early 20s, an entrepreneurial spirit took hold, and he started his first business, which, due to overconfidence and underfunding, resulted in failure. Prior to failing in business, John had fallen in love with Breda, to whom he had proposed marriage after just 6 weeks of dating. With little or no prospects in Cork, John decided to move to London, and as love would have it, Breda had decided to follow. While going to London with very little, they would return near 9 years later with two children, Leah and Sean, two dogs, Ben and Bob, a 40-foot trailer with possessions, and funds to start again after selling their home in Twickenham. In 2004, Breda became ill, and following a diagnosis of cancer, would die on March the 26th, 2005, aged just 43. Sean and Leah were then aged just 9 and 10, respectively. John's dad, Perry, gave advice and direction. He said, "Leah and Sean are all what matters now. You must be there for them." In 2007, John decided to rejoin the world and, as a first step, joined a local Toastmaster club in Bishopstown, and thus began a whole new path. John would start his own Toastmaster club in 2009, the Bishopstown Toastmasters, and would go to assist with the formation of a club in Apple, and would be asked by EMC and Ballincollig to help with the formation of their club. John would be awarded Distinguished Toastmaster, the highest award Toastmasters International can bestow on a member, in 2011. With the closure of the Clonakilty Toastmasters Club, John decided to try to create a new club, which he started in 2014, called West Cork Toastmasters. The club is thriving and meets with great support from the Celtic Ross Hotel every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. in beautiful Roscarbery. Today, John would introduce himself as a storyteller with a twist. John helps entrepreneurs tell the story of their ideas, their business, and their own story. John helps business owners and executives to craft their story and their presentations. Another area of public speaking which keeps John busy is the writing of wedding speeches, be that the best man's speech, the groom's, or the father of the bride's speech. He trains individuals in the effective delivery of speeches, in overcoming the fear of public speaking. John's passion for all things Toastmasters and his business of helping others in the area of public speaking, when he sees individuals gain confidence and find their voice, that is a great joy. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much.
John, did you have any fear in preparing for this programme?
Being a storyteller, putting my story together was the easy part. Compiling the music list was interesting, because I took the view that I would just go with my first feelings and the music that I really like. But looking over the list, I saw what a sad romantic I am in some respects with the list that you'll see as we go through them.
Why is it a sad romantic list? I quite enjoyed it.
It's a lot about love. It's a lot about what love is. And it's about love between friends.
So in your funeral, you're going to be spreading the love?
Absolutely. Life is for living and love and all that. So, yeah, absolutely.
You were bereaved at a very early age, John, losing your wife at the age of just 43. That must have been an awful shock to you.
Yeah. But I've often considered it was like a car crash, because we had a diagnosis in October 2004, and within 7 months, Breed had passed. And it was up to December, really, that I found out that Breed had only about 3 months to live. Breed didn't know till about 4 days before she died, because on the 21st of March, she had got the final test back, and all the way through, Breed's view was that I don't want to know about time, I don't want to know about prognosis, I'm fighting this. And that was the way she kept going right up to the 21st of March. And on the 21st of March, the test results came back, and a doctor, Mary Murphy, came in and had to tell Breed at that stage that she had about 8 weeks to live, and was offered the opportunity to go to Marymount and our home, and a combination of both. And during that consultation, Dr. Murphy suggested to Breed, why are you still fighting? And Breed sort of said, your man.
Meaning you.
Yeah. So, and then Dr. Murphy said, maybe it's time to start fighting. Maybe it's time to just to give up the fight. And Breed did. She gave up the fight that day, went into a coma that night, and passed on Saturday. So it was a tremendous shock, in the sense that even on Thursday, Friday, it still hadn't sunk in that we were at that. And worse still, it was a terrible shock for the kids, because while they knew their mum was sick, they came in on that Saturday morning, and then they were taken off to photo for the day. And when they came home, then I had to sit them down and tell them their mother had died, and that was a nightmare. So yeah, that was very, very hard.
And I'm sure the funeral must be a bit blurry now, looking back.
Yeah, it was. And it was a case of really lock around the kids. It was a burial on the Monday, and by Wednesday I got the kids in a car. We went up to Northern Ireland to a friend of ours, and I took them away for 4 or 5 days just to get away. And it was just back then, and sort of get back into school, and you know, then life sort of carries on. The bills still coming in, and people, and just life, just, you know, it doesn't stop, and you just really have to get back into it. And it's still hard to believe. That's nearly 12 years now that since Breed's gone.
And maybe you could tell us then, what would your own first choice be for your own funeral playlist?
Well, the one I've picked is The Pearl Fisher. I've always loved that song. It's a beautiful melody. There's a lovely flow to that. And interestingly, it's about friendship. And it's the friendship of two guys in this particular case. And I've been very lucky over the years. I've had two very close friends. One is in New Zealand. And we'd often chat. We met in London. We became great friends. And I'd often say to Mike, you know, I'd love him. And he'd say the same. And we had that sort of close friendship. And I have a friend in Cork, Ray. And we'd have that very close friendship. And it just is only a day between both of them. But they were always close friends. So I loved this song. And when I went in to look at it, and I thought, yeah, two guys can really have a really, you know, a loving relationship. And that's why I selected that one.
Fama, parre, fama, tra la voix.
did you find the palliative care services in preparing for Breed's death? What was the process? Because a lot of people fear that process.
Yeah, I mean, the support that we got from the hospitals was excellent, but there wasn't much palliative care involved because that was only coming to play after being told she had 8 weeks to live. And, you know, so she never got to Marymount. She was offered, but it never happened. But where it came into play significantly was for my kids and I. We thought we were invited, or Bree was going to be invited to Marymount, and she didn't get there, so that was going to be the end of our involvement. But strangely, Marymount came back to invite me, as a young adult at the time, to come to a monthly meeting with fellow adults who had lost a partner. And this meeting would be held in the old Marymount, and we'd come in once a month, and there was about 12, 14 people there, all who had lost a partner. And that was hugely significant to me, because it was that once a month I felt normal. This was my real world in here, amongst these people who could understand how I felt, I could understand how they felt. We all suffered in individual ways, but we all shared the same pain. And it was that 2 or 3 hours once a month where you could actually go into a room, and it was fantastic in the sense that there was one lady who had very young kids who couldn't go to the shop without everybody going into the car, whereas my kids were a little bit older. So we all had different nuances. Everybody outside that room didn't know what we were going through. Relatives, friends, no matter how good they were, they didn't understand, whereas that period in there was fantastic. They also provided a group support for the kids. So my kids were 9 and 10, so they were brought in with other kids who had lost a parent once a week for 6 weeks, for 2 hours, and they would paint and draw all about death and the funeral and the experience of that. But they were like us as adults, all together with kids who had experienced that. And they did a fantastic course in that. And it was tremendously beneficial to the kids. And then as we'd bring the kids up, we'd go into the kitchen, make teas and coffee. But there was 2 people there to make the teas and coffee. But they were also widowed, but 5, 6, 10 years on the road. So we could see these people as having survived. So I thought Marymount were brilliant in relation to the support we got afterwards. Never expected it, never knew it existed, but they were outstanding.
It must have been very difficult for Sean and Leah to have lost their mother when they were so young, and it was so unexpected. There was so little time for preparation.
Yeah, it was a nightmare. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think they both suffered. But where they are today, they're very happy, they're very outgoing, and they've come through this this nightmare in many respects. But they're stronger now. And I suppose one thing I always tried to instill in them from day one in relation to their mother was that their mother never did die in the sense that she lives through them. And I think that's, like, biologically that's correct. And they both have attributes. Like, Sean is the only person that could sing. His mum could sing. His mum was a draftswoman. He loves drawing, detailed drawing. And Leah is very like her mum, very buoyant, very outgoing. And at times, you know, today she looks very like her. So in that sense, she does live in, and I try to instill that into them. But yeah, it was very, very difficult for them, you know.
And you said that you found that the counselling sessions were the only safe space for you post-bereavement. And do you think that's because people just don't know how to talk to people who are bereaved?
They don't. You have to walk the walk. You know, you really do. And a lot of people find it very uncomfortable. And they just don't. You see people moving away. I help today with some people who have been bereaved. And that's a sense of anger with a lot of them. That they feel, you know, they're close friends. They go. And I always try and explain. And I've learned that it's not they're walking away. It's just they don't know how to deal with it. They just don't know how to help. And they feel the best way to help is stay away.
And what would you say the best way to help is?
I think it's about listening. But I think the ultimate way for anybody going through it is to find help with people that have gone through it. And I think that's where Marymount came in with that support. Because you can only really relate to somebody that knows what you're talking about. What can you do? But there's nothing you can do for somebody that's going through that. When I sit down with somebody that's going through this, all I try and do is listen. But they know I know, and that's what makes a difference. Marymount still provide that service today, and I was out there a couple of weeks ago. They were starting a new group, so I was asked to come out and sort of help with the orientation for the new group. And my point was, it's in here where you're going to feel normal.
And can you tell us what your next song for your playlist is?
The next one I picked was Breed's party piece, The Rose. Breed always sang that beautifully. We went to Munich many years ago, and we were in a music beer hall, and there was songs requested up, and unknowns to Breed, I put her name up, and she was called up. I got killed for that, but she sang The Rose, and it was fantastic. She sang it on her 43rd birthday, and her cousin sang it at her funeral, which was very, very difficult to do. But again, it's a beautiful, beautiful song.
Some say love, it is a river that drowns the tender reed. Some say love, it is a razor that leaves your soul to bleed. Some say
John, did you have any opportunity to discuss death with Breed before she died?
No. As I said, Breed got diagnosed in October, and from the diagnosis, Breed's attitude to the doctors was, don't tell me how much time I have, don't tell me what prognosis is, I'm fighting. And that stance was respected by doctors up to the 24th of March. So we had no opportunity to consider what was going to happen. So it was just... it just never happened, because then when she was told on the Thursday, that Thursday night she was in a coma, and then passed on the Saturday. So it would have been very hard to know how to have that conversation. I know other people who have gone through that had the opportunity to sit down and discuss, but we never got the opportunity, which in one way I'm glad we didn't, and in other ways I think it would have helped. But I know what Breed wanted above all else was that Lee and Sean would be looked after, and I know she died with the view that I would follow through on that and I would be there for them. So, no, we didn't. In terms of the kids, clearly they didn't get any understanding. But what was interesting, shortly after Breed died, they both asked the question, what's going to happen to them if anything happened to me? Which was a sad question to get back from the kids, because all certainty and all bets were off. You know, if it can happen to one, it can happen to the other. But fortunately, I was able to tell them I had a plan that if anything happened to me, that they would go and live with my sister. And that sort of looked after them. And it's interesting with the groups that I've worked with out in Marymount, kids, how resilient they are, how strong they are, and how very quickly they adapt and start to put their lives together. I saw a great talk by Brené Brown, and she was saying kids are hardwired for tough things, tough aspects of life, and they can pick up. I had found out about Breed's prognosis 3 months before she died, because I had to find out. I had to sort of get my own head prepared in terms of what was coming down the track. So I did ask the doctors, and reluctantly they told me, and I had told them I would not obviously be discussing that with Breed, which I didn't do. And that was very hard to carry that. But again, that time, the first place I went to was Arcos, and I just walked in and said, look, this is what I've got to deal with. And they were fantastic in their support.
So you had to keep the secret that you knew that Breed was terminal and not reveal that you knew to her?
Or to anybody. I mean, I couldn't tell her family, I couldn't tell anybody, because, you know, if anybody knew, Breed would know, and Breed didn't want to know.
And what were the services in Arcos like?
They were outstanding. You know, they were very supportive. Just going and being able to talk to people and saying, look, this is what's going on. And, you know, it was just being able to tell somebody this and then go home and be normal. They were fantastic.
What is your next selection for the funeral playlist?
Mine is Perhaps Love. John Denver and Placido Domingo. Again, it's a song I came across in my early 20s, and it really spoke to me about what is love and romantic love, and it's a lovely contrast in that song, and their two voices, one operatic, one sort of pop singer, and it's just a beautiful song.
Perhaps love is like a resting place, a shelter from the storm. It exists to give you comfort, it is there to keep you warm. And in those times of trouble, when you are most alone, the memory of love will bring you home.
Perhaps love is like a window, perhaps an open door. It invites you to come closer, it wants to show you more. And even if you lose yourself and don't know what to do, the memory of love will see you through.
Oh, love to some is like a cloud, to some as strong as steel.
For some a way of living, for some way to feel.
And some say love is holding on, and some say letting go. And some say love is everything, some say they don't know.
Perhaps love is like the ocean, full of conflict, full of pain. Like a fire when it's cold outside, thunder when it rains. If I forever and all my dreams come true, my memories of love will be of you.
some say love is holding on, and some say letting go.
And some say love is everything, and some say they don't know. Perhaps love is like the ocean, full of conflict, full of pain. Like a fire when it's cold outside, thunder when it rains.
If I should live forever and all my dreams come true, my memories of love will be all you.
John, post-bereavement, you've had a lot of time to reflect about death through counselling sessions and through your own research. What have you learned?
Life is very short. And as Breed and I were happily driving along the highway of life, oblivious to any concept of death, never entered into our head. And next minute, out of nowhere, life changes, and very fast. And that made me, over time, you know, really recognise what's the game about, you know, not to waste time, to focus very much on now, and try and maximise life in many ways, and to look at it and analyse, you know, what's best for me, how can I do the best out of my life, and drive on. I came across a nurse, Bronnie Ware. She was is a palliative care nurse in Australia, and she dealt with a lot of patients that were dying, and she actually compiled a list of five things most of the patients she dealt with would say on their deathbed. And I think they're very interesting, because the things that people say on their deathbed, and the top five are interesting if I go through those. The first one, I think, was I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself and not the life others expect of me. And I mean, I think it's so easy that in life we could spend our whole life and in a blink it could be over. It could be over through natural time and realise what happened in that space of time, because it can go so quickly and sometimes it can disappear very quickly. So that was interesting. The second one that she came up with was, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. You know, and you think, yeah, and some people do. Some people do get so caught up in work, so focused on, you know, what they do for a living, that they forget about their family, their life, their enjoyment. And it's that blinkered approach. And I think we had a bit of that here in the 2008s, an accumulation of stuff and forgetting what's really important. So that was an interesting one. The third one on the list was, I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. And that's a fascinating one as well. I suppose in us Irish, in many ways, are not very good at expressing our feelings. And it's a great barrier to relationships, to not have spent time to really tell someone how much you love them, how much they mean to you. Fortunately, Breed and I had a very open relationship, and says we would be very much of that communicative type. We've always expressed our love for each other and for our kids, so that was very open. But you can imagine a lot of people going through life and not having the time or that freedom to express how they feel for each other. Like, and that would be very sad to be on your deathbed, to look back and think, well, I didn't say how I felt. Number four on the list was, I wished I had stayed in touch with my friends. Again, that would be very sad. You know, if you have really good friends, like that first song I selected, one guy who was very close to us in London, he moved to New Zealand, but we still keep in contact. 2 or 3 years after Breed died, we went to visit him and his family out there, and we still keep in contact. No, he's 12 hours ahead. So I would be phoning him at 12 midnight, he'd be 12 o'clock, and you know, so we still, and that's very important, because they're good friendships, and you wouldn't want to lose them. And my other friend in Cork, who I still would see every week, and that's important. And I think when you develop good friendships, it's vital, no matter what distance or time or place, that they're kept together. And it was interesting too, with Breed had some great friends, and Ho, they came from the north, they came from England to Farbury's funeral, and were able to express what the, how much she meant to them, which I, that was lovely. The fifth one was, I wish I had let myself be happier, which is an interesting one, because happiness is a choice in many ways. Do we choose, do we invest our time in happiness? And happiness doing simple things. The one thing I found with the kids after Breed died, they were very determined that our things that we did as a family would continue. For example, we would always go to Garnish Island a couple of times a year. The kids insisted going back there every year, a couple of times a year. And if I said to them tomorrow we were going down to Garnish, they'd go. Barley Cove, Christmas, getting a Christmas tree, who decked it, all small little traditional things. And they were all kept, and they would insist, even though they were hard and very difficult things to actually to go back there for the first time, but we kept going back, kept going back. And that made them a lot happier in the sense that we didn't lose that sense of tradition. And I think they're important. But I think that, you know, the overall list is very good. And the other one I did come across was a quote from Steve Jobs. And I thought, I'm a great fan of Steve Jobs from a public speaking point of view, as a presenter. He was one of the best. And he had this wonderful quote from a speech he gave in 2005 as a commencement address to the students of Stanford University. He had a diagnosis of cancer. He'd come through that and he was looking forward. So he came up with this quote. And in relation to that, I think it's excellent. He said, no one wants to die. Even people who want to go to heaven don't want to die to get there. And yet death is the destination we shall all share. No one has ever escaped it. And that is as it should be, because death is very likely the single best invention of life. It is life's change agent. It clears out the old and makes way for the new.
John, your next song choice.
Believe it or not, it's Imagine.
And why is it Imagine?
Well, Imagine by John Lennon was a song, I think it was released in the late 70s, and it just blew my brain away. The idea that we could have a world without religion, a world without borders, a world without possessions. When you consider today, borders are such an issue. I mean, with Britex and the borders and the states and borders and its borders, you know, it's just a nightmare. We still haven't got our head around borders. This idea that no religion, I thought, wow, you know, as a young teenager, imagine a world with no religion. And there's a world without, I mean, it was so utopian in its view, and we are so far from it. The idea that in reality, when it comes down to it, we are one people, we have one planet, and that's it. But yes, we have all these artificial borders, we have all this need for possessions, and when we look back through our latest disaster with possessions, we still haven't learnt that wonderful, simple, utopian image of Imagine.
Imagine all the people
sentiments in that wonderful song is imagine there's no religion. What does that mean for your own beliefs about what happens to you when you die?
What happens when I die? Well, for me, in terms of when it comes to a funeral, I have insisted on cremation, so there'll be no question. What happens to me after that? I have a spiritual perspective in that I've often said to the kids that Breed lives on in a biological sense, but I also believe she lives on in a spiritual sense, that she's there protecting us all the times, and I've always felt that, and on very different occasions, that her presence is always there. It was interesting, a few years ago, there was a great movie called What the Bleep Do We Know? And it focused very much on quantum mechanics, and that tied back to very much a Buddhist perspective, that we are all energy, and energy never goes anywhere, it just changes. And that would be my own view. I wouldn't have a religious perspective on heaven or hell or those ideas. So I think we have an energy that can live on. I think we can influence others. That would be my view on it. I'm very much focused on now and living and not ever too concerned about what happens afterwards. I never liked the idea of the party, because I always saw that as a selling agent for a lot of the tradition religions, that be good here and we're going to have a party afterwards. I think we should be good here and whatever happens afterwards, let that look after itself. So focus on the here and now and how much good we can do in the present for its own sake.
And in practical terms, John, at the time of death, it's usual that there is a burial ritual, a funeral ritual, and typically it has been part of religion to provide those rituals. But if you don't necessarily belong to a particular religion, how do you see those practical rituals happening? Because comfort is very necessary at a time of death.
What I've seen of late, one was a particular one of cremation, and I thought it was a lovely service. There was no religious aspect to it. Coffin was brought in. There was music played. There was people got up and gave their views on the individual. And I thought that was just a lovely service in itself. I would certainly not want myself going into a church. I would not want that sort of service, because it's not where I believe. It would do nothing for me. But I thought the whole cremation was a lovely service. People just said a few words, the music was played over, and then they went on to wherever afterwards and had that bit of celebration. I think it's very short-lived. And I think certainly in many ways it's over-egged and overplayed. I don't think there's no great benefit. You know, I go to funeral services today, and I saw in West Cork, in Roscarbery, funeral service was just stupendous in terms of its tradition and its ritual. I thought it was absolutely a beautiful service where, you know, and it offered a lot of support. But that was that part of that tradition. A tradition, I thought, and I mean, it was a lovely, lovely service, the whole way it was done. But that's not me. And I couldn't feel part of that. Whereas for me, what would be good, have your cremation, a short service, my playlist, and down the pub afterwards, and then, you know, pay for a few drinks for people and say, yeah, that's it. And maybe a few speeches.
I would hope there'd be a few speeches. And what would be your songs on your funeral playlist for the crematorium?
The other one I have is Bob Marley. Great fan of Bob. A man that came from terrible poverty, a wonderful musician, some wonderful songs. And the one I selected is This Love? Again, he puts that question out there, and he answered in his own unique way. So that would be one that would be important, because the one thing I would come back and haunt people about, my, if there was any sadness, I would try and say, look, lads, you know, it's not a time for crying, it's not a time for sadness. I would hope I would be able to look back in a life of that was full of joy, full of giving and, you know, development, and, you know, that not something to be sad about. So that would be Bob.
I wanna love you.
Music is its enduring nature, and that's a wonderful song. What do you think you'd like to be remembered for?
Well, I suppose the title of Dad is important to me. I'd like to be thought of in terms of my kids, that, you know, that I was a good dad to them. That would be important. I suppose I could be described as a talker. I did a psychometric test there recently, and they came back with three descriptions: a talker, a communicator, and a teacher. And there was talk that I should have paid 100 euros for this test, but no, the company had paid for it. I mean, what I get a great joy out of life is helping people to find their own voice and to see them get out of their own way, and I've had great fun in that over the last 9 years. True Toastmasters and true individuals, helping others to make a difference. Whether I'm remembered for that or not, that's not really the issue. But that's what's important, helping others just to get out of their own way, find their own voice, and get on with things.
And any regrets? What do you think you might regret most?
Well, I suppose, obviously, I regret not having more time with Breed. That's a big regret in life in many ways. And in ways, I've often said to people, if Breed came back today, she probably wouldn't recognize me in certain ways, because it certainly has changed me in certain ways. I certainly, you know, would have been, I'm a lot calmer, a lot more focused on the present, probably a bit more compassionate than I was in certain ways, because I was very driven in certain directions. Regrets? Yeah, I suppose the biggest regret is that we didn't get more time together. There's a friend of mine, he's going through this, and his wife, they were together for 40 years, and he's suffering, and he's of the view that, when is it going to stop, Jan? You know, I'm 18 months into this grief business, and it's still hurting, and I'm saying, you know, there's no clock. You just, you know, you go through it, and if you've had 40 years, that grief is a reflection of what you had. So, yeah, other than that, no great regrets.
It's a wonderful thing to be able to say. And then an epitaph. Would you have an epitaph that you would use?
He has stopped talking. Or maybe he's paused, you know. I'm well known for my pause and the power of pausing. I love the one Spike Milligan had, or I think he has it. I told you I was sick, which I thought was very good. I don't know what I even have at a gravestone. I'm not sure. I don't think I will. Yeah, he's finally stopped talking, I suppose that would be.
Could you introduce your final song choice, please?
My final song choice is Time to Say Goodbye. A lovely, lovely song. Andrea Bocelli brought it out, I think, 2004. And I know at the time when we played it at home, Breed was concerned that it was a reflection on where she was going and stuff. But I had a friend who knew Italian, and the song is about where we're going together. And it was, he actually came to Cork, I think it was June, July. Breed died in March, and a friend, two very good friends of mine, got me a ticket to see him up in Collins Barracks. And that was very difficult to sit there, because it was a song I so associated with Breed and I, but a beautiful song. So, Time to Say Goodbye.
Thank you, John.
Sogno all'orizzonte, mancano le parole. Sì, lo so che non c'è luce in una stanza quando manca il sole. Se non ci sei tu con me, sì. Le finestre mostrano tutto il mio cuore che è acceso. Chiudi dentro me la luce che ho incontrato per strada.
Sogno all'orizzonte, manca le parole. Io sì, lo so che sei con me, tu mia luna, tu sei qui con me. Mio sole, tu sei qui con me.
Bye.
thanks very much, John, for sharing your views and your experience. It's been very valuable.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Endnotes with me, Sheila Broderick. We are currently recording interviews for this series. If you have views you would like to share about death, dying, funerals, and the afterlife if you believe in one, and would like to share your own funeral playlist, please get in touch. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Clonline Radio and the web at clonlineradio.com, where you can also find podcasts of previous shows. Thanks for listening. Thank you.